Good morning. It's Wednesday. It's 9 o'clock. It's time for The Conversation. My name's Graham, and I'll be your host today. The Conversation is KMUN's live call-in show, where you call in and weigh in on the topic of the week. Today's topic is the concept of originality. Where do we find originality these days? What does originality mean to us these days? Where does it exist? Where have you seen it? I would love to hear your example of originality in any form or genre that you have experienced lately. This could be music, science, thought, clothing design. For me, audio circuit design, dance, architecture, agriculture, medicine. So that's today's topic on The Conversation, but first, we're going to hear from The Conversation's resident historian, Ron Craig. And Ron likes to bring the U.S. history, but today I understand that we're going to be getting into a little bit of Oregon history. So Ron, I see you on Zoom there. Go ahead and unmute yourself. Beautiful. Welcome to the show, Ron. How are you?
Oh, I'm good to go.
Whoops. There we go. Theme song.
It's kind of crazy. Like I said, being an Oregonian, a lot of the history to me is kind of, I won't say comical, but amusing. And I was with a few people, this is about a year ago, and I made a comment about the idea of the Beach Boys. And they kind of looked at me like, what does the Beach Boys have to do with Oregon? Well, they said their eyes got a little larger and stuff. It's the fact that the Beach Boys from Oregon history were originally the Pendletones, which went along with the idea of Pendleton.
Right.
Any Oregonian understands what Pendleton's about. And beyond just blankets, they do all kinds of garments stuff, so I won't get into an ad for Pendleton. But the idea that the Pendletones, that was their original name. And if anybody from the baby boomer generation or such can look at any of the early photos of the Beach Boys, they were sitting there with Pendleton shirts on. And so with the idea that that was original name. And so later on, they decided to change it. But basically what it was all about was the idea that the Beach Boys back in the days in Southern California, when the sun goes down, they would put on their Pendleton shirts or their t-shirts. And so that became the whole thing. And so Pendleton, like I said, I'm not doing ads for Pendleton. They have shirts now that are called board shirts.
Interesting.
And if people are looking at me and they say, yeah, Ron, where'd you dig that up at? Anyway, I don't go into the details as far as believing me or not, but it's one of those sort of curious things, like I said, from history platform, Oregon history, that amuses me, especially when I'm in a group of Oregonians, so to speak, or looking at that. And then the other little historical breadcrumb, and I, like I said, being an Oregonian, some of these things are just, I know about them for whatever reason, because I'm a curious sort of guy. But I had posted U.S. History Oregon, and it was FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, coming to Oregon to dedicate Timberline Lodge. Mm-hmm. Now, once again, I have friends that have, you know, have never even been at the Timberline Lodge or understand the history of it. Well, I won't go into all the really significance of it as far as building it. But when FDR came there to dedicate it, I posted these photographs of him, and he's getting out of the car, and everybody know that FDR had some physical issues to deal with. And somebody says, well, I didn't know he skied. And I said, well, I said, you know, what do you do with a comment like that? So I just kind of said, well, no, he has some physical issues. I don't think he was there to skiing and stuff. But it's just one of those things, as I said before, as far as history or, you know, close to home, our history is really kind of interesting with me.
Now, and, what year was that the Timberline Lodge was dedicated?
I want to say 33 or something like that. I'm not sure the exact date on stuff like that. But anybody who's visited Timberline Lodge, which I encourage it, the front portion, it's a little kind of deck or patio there. It kind of swings out over the parking lot. And there's a plaque actually there that commemorates the fact that he was there. And as far as, you know, dedicating it. And prior to that, like I said, it was a kind of a long drive back in those days. He had gone to Bonneville Dam, which also had been, you know, part of the whole pyramids as far as building and infrastructure and so on and so forth and stuff. But it's always kind of humorous to be able to see that. And then to keep on the Pendleton sort of line as far as history, back in World War II, Doolittle's Raiders, like a lot of people know this, were actually training in the Pendleton area as far as the bombing runs and things of that nature. And like I said, once again, it's one of those situations for its history that, you know, people maybe know a little bit about it, but they know what the connection was. So this is, once again, not a number of years as far as Ron's history. I'm sitting watching, listening to public broadcasting, and they're interviewing these people from the survivors, the guys that are still from the Doolittle Raiders. And they're in Pendleton because they're opening up this area to kind of commemorate that as far as Doolittle's Raiders during World War II. And so at the same time, there was another group that was involved called the Triple Nickel. And the Triple Nickel were essentially kind of an arm of the Buffalo Soldiers. And people look at it, okay, the Triple Nickel, you look at a nickel, one side has a buffalo on it. So with the idea that these guys had come from, I believe it was, South Carolina, and they were a battalion of, and what was so interesting that they were destined to go to the European theater, but the war ended before they could be reassigned. But anyway, the broader scope was the fact they were brought to Pendleton to be able to put out fires as an airborne unit because the fact that the Japanese were sending these incendiary bombs over to catch the fires in Northern California, Idaho, and Oregon as far as during World War II, and start these fires. So they brought these guys, which I talked, there was two of them that actually returned to Pendleton. This would have been about 15 years ago, I said, 15 years ago, had returned. And the guy, the one guy, he was in total tears. He had not been back there since the 40s. And for to experience that, along with standing there with the guys that were part of the Doolittle Raiders, to me was just almost, you know, I can't even describe how I felt. It was like this sort of five-star historical event for me to be able to do it. But having said that, you have all these African Americans that were coming here to be able to the paratroopers that put these fires out. So they had the guys with the Park Service, which are in Oregon and Idaho, white guys, and which I say that for the point that you have these guys that came out of, like I say, coming out of the South Forest, South Carolina, in that area, and all of a sudden they have these guys that are from Idaho and stuff. They're teaching these guys not to jump out of airplanes, but what to do when once they hit the ground as far as putting these fires out. And it was such a incredible circumstances. And there are a couple of documentaries that have been put out about that. But one of the things was really kind of crazy was the fact that I think it was probably once about every other couple of weeks, these guys would get together and they'd march down the main street of Pendleton, Oregon, and all their uniforms and everything. And it was a connection that Oregon, as far as, you know, World War II and stuff, that a lot of people really don't even understand. So once again, it's one of those little curious things here in Oregon that happened. And as I was leading up to this, saying that I heard this on the public broadcasting, and I called my colleague and I said, get your camera. We got to go to Pendleton. So I went and picked him up and we drove from Portland all the way to Pendleton, Oregon to meet these guys. Like I said, it was a totally incredible experience. Cool. And once again, it's one of those sort of breadcrumbs because I really encourage people to look at that because as far as the Doolittle Raiders and paratrooper guys coming here to an area that, you know, as far as having a cross-cultural experience and stuff was just something that was probably really very unusual.
Well, I'm doing a little parallel research while you're talking to us about this, and I see that the reason that they were being trained as smoke jumpers, and this is essentially the first crew that was ever trained to be smoke jumpers, it was because the Japanese were sending incendiary balloons over the ocean to set our northwestern forests on fire. Does that sound right?
Absolutely. And there was a family, like I said, so many things out there. I'm not sure it was, I want to say Baker. I'm not sure the exact, well, correct me, that one of the bombs went off and killed, I think it was three or four, about five people and stuff. And among them were some young people, children. They were also killed, who died during that explosion. And the bomb was just there and they didn't know what it was about. And as I understand, it was like a church outing, picnic and stuff. And they just went over there and looked at it or kind of touched it and blew up.
Wow.
And we didn't know about that for years later, because once again, the government or the military did not want people generally to know that the Japanese were sending these bombs over, because it would send panic. And I think that it's, you know, rightfully so, the fact that didn't know really what was going on. But it's just really an incredible experience to be able to look at that from retrospect, from Oregon history.
Yeah. Well, hey, Ron, can I put you on the spot and ask you if you want to chip in on our originality discussion today? Is there something that strikes you as a really good example of originality that's current?
Oh, I think I could probably go with that.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think?
And, it's as far as originality, I think that, you know, I look at it as our own, you know, experience, as you said earlier, stuff, you know, how it reflects on you. Well, growing up as a young kid in Portland, and I have to keep referring to my own history because it's part of the history. And as far as, you know, being involved in certain aspects growing up, and it's like automobiles.
Yeah.
And it's not like a male thing, you know, I have friends across the board. And I was in a situation where my father worked on foreign cars. And this is back in the day, everybody's driving, you know, 57 Chevys and all this other stuff. Well, I had no idea until I started going up to the shop where he's working on these cars. And it's just like, you know, they're all driving General Motor cars, all this stuff. But the short of it is, they wouldn't be considered exotic cars, but Mercedes-Benz and Rolls-Royces and cars like that, and Porsches. And my dad, you know, he was just a basic working class sort of guy. And he just thought these people were just really weird because they were so particular about their cars and everything. And so he just said he would never own a car like that. And they were, you know, it's very expensive, you know. So looking at that, and as a, you know, modest African-American working for these cars, and I fell in love with them. Mm-hmm. And there's a photograph somewhere around here of a 15-year-old sitting in, like, people know these cars. It was a, I think it was a 1957 Mercedes-Benz Gullwing. Those things are going for, like, I mean, $2 million, something like that, you know, absurd, you know. But it was always, like you said, the originality and things like that. People said, well, why do you like these old cars? Well, it's because that's what my dad did and stuff. And so the originality and looking at things and how they express, and it's not about, you know, you see people that are doing all kind of weird things with their cars and stuff nowadays and stuff, but it's the idea that for me, it was art.
Yeah.
Because I was looking at cars that were Italian, things like that. And it's just the fact of, it was different. You know, sure, we had, you know, Cadillacs with fin tails, all this stuff, which is part of the whole landscape for me. But the fact of looking at something like that and looking at it as an art form. And I think it was just sort of curious to me and stuff to be able to do it. So I don't know if that takes it anywhere.
That's great. Yeah, I think cars are a really good example, because there's a lot of different places you can be creative and original. And so the actual look of the car, the external body of it, is one place where originality can exist. But then also in the engine, you know, when did we go from manual to automatic transmission? Somebody had to come up with an original idea for all those orbital gears and things. I only know about transmissions when they fail. That's about all I know. But I know it's a complex deal in there.
Yeah.
So I was kind of looking into the concept of originality, and let me just pause and reframe for a sec. You're listening to the conversation, and I'd love it if you called in and joined the conversation. The number's 503-325-0010. Only call if you want to be on the air. We're putting calls on the air right now, and we're talking about examples of originality. As a musician, it's really easy for me to think of where originality really exists in the musical world. I think that we all understand that pop music is pretty thoroughly regurgitated these days. There's not a lot of new ideas in the pop music realm, but there's so many other genres of music where creativity and originality can still exist. Frank on Facebook commented that Frank Zappa is a good example of originality with the way he got into music. So I thought that was a good example. What do you think is a good example of originality? Give us a call, 503-325-0010. And I think that we should also stick with tradition, and we should just throw an icebreaker question out there, because these are a lot of fun, and it's a good way to get the phone ringing. It's a good way to warm you up on the other end of the phone. I'm curious what your least favorite food was as a child, and if you still hate it, or whether you love it now. So for me, couldn't do tomatoes, couldn't do avocados, couldn't do broccoli, but now I love them. What about you, Ron? What did you hate as a kid, and do you still hate it?
I hated it then, I hated it now, and it was liver and onions.
Oh, wow, yeah.
It was one of those things with me personally that, you know, go ahead, try it, you'll like it. I said, no, I don't want it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, curiosity, I started looking at what is a liver? What does a liver do? And I looked at it and I said, oh my God. It pushed me even further, said, no, I really can't deal this. But liver and onions, that was it. Other than that, I'm a food guy. I really enjoy cooking and food and things like that and sampling. But liver and onions, don't even bring it anywhere near me. So.
Thinking of originality when it comes to food, there is a chef that I really like who's on TV called Jacques Pepin, and he kind of sort of invented fast food, which is not necessarily something you might be super proud of, but he was, I guess, maybe the head chef for Howard Johnson Hotels in the U.S., and so he was the first one to cook at enormous scale, where he would do these gigantic vats of clam chowder, for example, and figuring out how to make. And the goal with Howard Johnson was to, anywhere in the country, if you're staying at a Howard Johnson, you can order the same meal and it tastes exactly the same. And so for the traveling salesman and things, there's just that, I guess people like that familiarity. So that was the goal there. So there's so much room for creativity and originality, though, in cooking. So there you have it, everybody listening, 503-325-0010. Love to hear what kind of food you couldn't stand as a kid and whether you enjoy it now or whether you still don't. And then the main topic of the show, originality. Where does originality exist these days? I was looking into what the definition of original is, or originality. And so one definition of original is it was present or existing from the beginning. It's the first or the earliest. So you could say you're the original owner of a house. And you could also say that original means it was created directly and personally by a particular artist and not a copy or imitation. It's something that serves as a model or basis for imitations or copies. And so I think that that's, to me, that's kind of the standout definition. Is it a copy of something else, or is it the thing that copies are made of? And so maybe that Mercedes-Benz had the first gull-wing doors, but there's maybe been a couple other cars that tried to imitate that that original styling.
Well, Back to the Future.
Yeah, the DeLorean, right.
Yeah. But like I said, it's one of those things that, you know, as people have said, the old cliche about, you know, imitating someone and stuff, it's a flat type of flattery.
Sure.
But, you know, I could sit there and probably get some things out and make a drawing that looked like a Picasso, but still at the same time, the fact that Picasso is Picasso. And I think as far as originality, for me, I think a lot of times right now, as far as the fashion and style industry, as far as clothing, gets to the point of originality. Because if you go to the fashion shows and everything like that, that's what it is. You know, kind of the tagline, and that's no guarantee, because every year I try to look at the, they have a fashion, you know, show they have in Paris and stuff, and I always go online and look at some of the weird things that are coming on. But basically, the guideline is the fact of being original. But still, again, does that mean that I want to wear a hat that has spikes coming off the side of it or whatever it is because it's original? Probably not. But still, again, somebody else looks at that and takes it to another direction. And that originality, you know, kind of bumps them to another, you know, zone.
So, yeah. I think the reason I wanted to do this one as a topic today is just that sort of question of, are there any new ideas under the sun? Has it all been done before? Has every song been written? Has every poem been written? And to me, the answer is a pretty clear no. I think there's still room for originality. But I do think there's a good tendency for repetition or building off of the work of others. Yeah.
But I think overall, you're absolutely right as far as being able to do it because, you know, both of us, you know, should I say, victims of that circumstance, you know, as we talked about the whole bohemian sort of approach to life. Like I say, when I looked at that, I said, yeah, that's the doorway I want to go through. And it was kind of funny, originality, think about, once again, cultural things. And as far as beatniks, which were the, should I say, the pre-cultures of sort of the hippie generation or flower power, whatever it is. And I used to look at them, you know, and what got me about originality was the poetry. Because every time you had, you know, as far as beatniks, somebody was sitting there, you know, reading poetry. And it didn't really have to, it was just off the top. And it was original, because they just did it. And I thought, wow, that's really crazy. I like that. But then again, at the same time, they're all smoking and all sorts of stuff. It seemed kind of depressing to some degree. And that's why the idea of looking at, you know, a bohemian perspective, you know, its originality, you know, is the fact of looking at something as far as a beatnik. But that's only a personal preference as a young kid looking at those sort of things. But yeah, I think it has always been kind of a flashpoint with me as far as going from one point to the next.
So my good friend Wikipedia says that the notion or the modern idea of originality is tied to Romanticism. And so that notion is called romantic originality. When was the bohemian cultural kind of apex? Was that anywhere near the Renaissance or when was that heyday, Ron?
Well, I honestly, there was no date to it. You know, if you look at it as far as, I mean, date as far as culturally, it's a fact because, you know, you look at the people that were, should I say, out of World War II generation and stuff, that's coming back to this country and stuff. And I think a lot of those guys, the next generation, so got into that. And I think it's like one of those situations where this is remotely related to it, but all of a sudden, the men specifically that came back from World War II, when they got back here, the prices or the availability of motorcycles went through the roof because the fact that idea of being that original sort of concept of motorcycles and being out there was different. And like I said, the motorcycle and should I say the beatniks, and then as far as the bohemian for me looking at it, so it was just kind of on the edge of kind of the disappearance of beatniks, because I think that the bohemian was a broader scope, because everybody, and look at any films, footage, or whatever you want, or photographs, all beatniks pretty much were in, you know, black clothes and maybe a beret or something like that, smoking cigarettes and, you know, very, you know, sort of, I don't say focused, but where a bohemian perspective was a lot broader. And for me, I think it's still, you know, both of the sort of cultural directions are based on, say, originality and the concept of accepting people. And I think to me that was really, really important.
Yeah, and to clarify, Bohemia was a region of the Czech Republic. And so we're not talking about the, you know, the place or the race. We're talking about these, you know, bohemianism, right?
Right.
So my good friend Wikipedia here is saying that a bohemian could denote a socially unconventional person, especially one who is involved in the arts. It's pretty simple, but pretty straightforward.
Amen.
Yeah.
I mean, I see that tattoo on you.
Thanks. Yeah. So we have not gotten a single call. I think the phones are working. 503-325-0010. If you're listening, give us a call. You can go with the easy icebreaker question, or you can go with the more thoughtful question. Icebreaker is, what kind of food could you not stand as a kid? Big question is, what's an example of originality in our culture today? And the phone did ring. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. I, as a child, could never stand artificial cheese, like the Velveeta stuff or the American cheese. I always thought it tasted like plastic.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I liked all food. I liked variety. And I think that creativity is out in the universe, and if people open themselves spiritually to being receptive to creative ideas, they come to them. I recently read a book by Melissa Gilbert, and she's talking about she had an idea for a book, but it came to her, and she didn't follow through on it. And another author wrote a story having all the same things, and she happened to meet him and or know this lady, and it was very strange because they hadn't talked about the book or shared the ideas, but it was like that thought had wound around in the universe, and somebody else took that idea and used it. And look at Mozart. He's four. He was creative.
Right.
So it's out there, and it's tappable by everyone.
That's such a good perspective, but let me ask you this. Does that mean that originality doesn't exist, that we're just antennas picking up a signal that already existed? And we're just, what we think of as the original output is a copy of that spiritual input that we received.
I think it's a combination.
Mm-hmm. Because it couldn't happen without us, right?
Right. It couldn't happen without us.
Yeah.
And it couldn't happen if we weren't receptive to it.
Right. I've read a lot of musicians who think of their creative output as not being from them.
Right.
So I think you're right on the money there. Well, thanks for the call.
Okay.
Take care. And we had a second caller call in. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Graham. I go along with the liver and onions.
Okay.
And any other organ meat. And as a child, we ate a lot of boiled beef tongue because it was cheap. And when was the last time you saw one of those in the grocery store? And as an adult, I really enjoy eating squash. That was something as a child that wasn't absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
And for originality, I think it just kind of floats by and we grasp it.
Mm. So two votes for inspiration.
Yes.
How about an example in any genre where you think originality showed itself?
We could go out there and look at cell phones.
Yeah.
As simple as they were, they look like a World War II battle phone that took three people to carry. And now you carry them in your pocket, and they do everything except wash the dishes.
Yeah, I think technology is such an easy place to point to where originality exists currently. There's so much focus on that. And when Ron mentioned cars, I immediately thought of Tesla and the current advances in electric cars.
Yes. You know, Henry Ford and his any color as long as it's black and it had four wheels and an engine you cranked.
Yeah.
And it worked. Didn't work necessarily well, but it worked.
Yeah, well, and look how far we've come.
And think of the little car that used to be a boat and the one you could put wings on and fly.
Wait, those exist?
They did. Back in the probably late 40s.
Yeah, that was a great flashpoint.
Well, I know where I'm going when they finally invent a time machine then.
Oh, wouldn't that be fun?
I can remember reading Popular Mechanics as a kid, and there was just nothing but flying cars in those magazines. And,
well, it was Popular Mechanics and Mad Magazine.
Right.
Those two were...
Yeah, the lines were blurred.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, any other thoughts on originality for us today?
Original dinner tonight would be good. Did you want to come up and cook it?
Oh, well. Hmm.
Remember, no organ meat. Oh, yeah. And no wild ducks.
Okay. Yeah. I mentioned Jacques Pepin earlier, and he grew up in France, and I don't think their family was very wealthy, and so the organ meat was just the cheapest meat. And
indeed.
So they worked really hard to figure out how to make it palatable, which I guess is just like a lot of butter and heavy cream and...
a little bit of wine.
Yeah.
In the cook, not necessarily the dish. And oxtail is another thing that used to be big when I was a child.
And
right now,
like,
you could probably buy a herd of cattle for what it would cost for an oxtail.
Wow.
Braise it off, make it into a soup. Yeah.
So that one's good.
And things that don't exist. Maybe if we go to a Basque restaurant, we can get oxtail.
I think there's a big Basque population in Idaho somewhere.
Yes, Boise.
Yes. Yeah.
There's a little Basque square down by the Capitol building. Just don't go there when it's 115 degrees outside.
Sounds like good advice.
Okay, Graham, you have a good day, and good luck with gaining more on your drive.
Yeah.
I've still got another call to make to you folks to give you some more, so...
Well, thanks for doing some pitching for me. I was going to touch on some drive numbers in just a second, so thanks for that shout-out.
You're welcome.
Have
Y'all
a great
take
day.
Care.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
503-325-0010 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation. That was great to get a couple of calls right in a row, but now we have three open lines again. So 503-325-0010. We'd love to hear from you. Easy question, icebreaker. What kind of food could you not stand as a kid? And can you eat it now and enjoy it, or do you still not like it? And then the big topic of the day that I would love to hear your thoughts on is where originality exists in our world today. I always think of music, and there's a lot of unoriginal music, but I think there's still a lot of very original music as well. The 20th century composers felt like they just had to do something different, whether it sounded good or not. So 12-tone music was born, or atonal music. You had to use all 12 notes of the chromatic scale before you could repeat a note. You know, that's not my favorite kind of music, but they were being creative. They were being original. So you got to respect that. But like our last caller said, we are about 3/4 of the way through our spring pledge drive. And we're doing really well on our goal. We're above 50,000. We're at $51,574 as of today. So we are less than 20,000 away from our goal. We are more than 2/3 of the way there. And we'd love to hear from you with a call of support. 503-325-0010 once the show has ended, because right now we're taking people on the air and we do have a call. Good morning. What's up?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hi. On the food, it'd be Brussels sprouts. I grew up in the early 50s, and my mother would cook Brussels sprouts until they were green little ping pong balls. And she would serve me, if we had a family of four, and everybody's done at the dinner table. The dishes are done. Everybody's in watching TV or doing something, and I would be closed into the kitchen with these three, to me, they were huge Brussels sprouts. They're about the size of my thumb. And I just couldn't tolerate them.
But how about now?
Oh, I love them. No, and God bless my mother. She was an excellent cook, but she would boil them until they were tasteless. And, and oh, by the way, the pet dog was gone out of the kitchen. All my milk is gone. Once I've vomited about the third time, my mother says, okay, that's enough. It'd be almost... child abuse today, maybe. I'm not sure.
I think the preparation has a lot to do with our taste,
Graham,
as a kid.
It's simply, yeah. And you just have an idea in your head. How about throw some butter in there, and some little salt or coarse pepper, you know what I mean, garlic or something.
Yeah, the broccoli
for me. Yeah, I dig them now.
My mom would boil the broccoli, and the heads of them in particular would totally make me gag. And they're just mushy boiled broccoli. And
and then talking about originality and creativity, yeah. Things, I believe circumstances, it's like a burst of energy to us. Remember when the last time you were really surprised I mean, something you have to be, and then it kind of, it opens you up.
Uh-huh.
And I believe that our circumstances in life will promote creativity and originality. You know, we look at wars. Well, the war on hunger, for example. I mean, we've made so many good strides in it, and there's so much work still to do. The world wars, war on drugs, war on this and that. We could go into, I'm not sure where to venture on that, but I believe that the circumstances create opportunities for us to get out of our box and really, it's an opening. It's really an awakening, kind of.
I was thinking of that quote that necessity is the mother of invention.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no, go ahead. What do you think?
Did you ever listen to Mothers of Invention?
Well,
those guys are great.
Yeah, very inventive and original and creative musicians.
You know, and you were talking about the beatniks. Mm-hmm. My parents knew some beatniks that lived in Greenwich Village in New York City in the old days. This is the late 40s, early 50s, really early 50s. And they were, talk about creativity, originality. They, you know, people would either understand a beatnik or an alternative way of living, thinking, existing, you know, or they didn't. And so I believe that was.
So who was the original beatnik? Was it Richard Brautigan or, no?
I thought it was Dobie Gillis.
Dobie Gillis?
Maynard G. Krebs.
Yeah, that was it.
Remember Maynard? He was allergic to work. It worked. No, you know, that's Abby Hoffman? No, he's a little later.
He created some original experiences for people.
Oh, big, yeah. And then, isn't that interesting how we evolved from the beatniks into other cultural groups, and all of them have, I think, survived. They're just low key now. But you know, I know people. I'm 70, and I know folks that are older than I am that still have a belief of, you know, nothing wrong with a good hippie. You know.
Yeah.
Because just their way they were sharing, loving people, and it scared people because they were. Because they were so real. I truly believe that. And there was quite a resistance. And then next thing you know, your sons and your daughters and stuff, they're, you know, next thing you know, you got Woodstock.
Yeah, an effort towards an original way of life that's outside of capitalism.
Well, yes, of course. You know, all the men and women came back from World War II, and, you know, they started working in the factories. And then you know, settled in their small communities, and that's what you did. You stayed at the mill for 30 years, retired, and then you're gone, you know. And they thought outside the box. They didn't want to work at the mill for 30 years. They wanted to be more involved, you know, in things. So, yeah.
Well,
I give them credit for that. But, yeah, it's a good program today. Thanks, Graham, for running us. I like it.
Well, cheers. Oh, thanks for calling in. Yep, and always roast your Brussels sprouts and broccoli.
Oh gosh.
Never
oh,
boil.
Yeah. Grill up.
Olive oil, salt, and crushed black pepper, just like you said.
Oh, so much flavor.
Yeah.
You want to bring flavor out, that's what you do. And, it's, you know, it's the simple things that really, truly are the best.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your call.
Oh, thank you, Graham.
Have a great day. We're talking originality today, and we've heard about music, we've heard about cooking, we've heard about cars, we've heard about scientific advancements. What about some more artistic places where originality exists? So maybe, are there any fine artists out there, like painters or ceramicists or sculptors? Is it a matter of finding a new medium? Like, how does originality occur now, after we've been through so many sort of art fads and phases? Like, where else can you go? Where else can you take it when you've got a palette of paint and a canvas? Let's hear from our next caller. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm excited over the people thinking about how to generate electricity and the wave generation project at Newport, Oregon. The PAC wave has me excited. And I think there are maybe four new electric generating wave machines being tested, and so those machines were being created. And in Orkney, Scotland, the little islands of northern Scotland, they have four generating machines, two tidal and two wave, and they make hydrogen when they have too much electricity, and they run their little fleets around on the hydrogen. Anyway, I'm very excited over that. The other more visual creativity right now are the spring gardens, which I love.
And are you crediting that creativity to the gardener or to Mother Nature?
The gardeners. I mean, when you walk around Astoria, not everybody's into their gardens, but the people that are, I mean, it's the gardener's hand taking nature's bounty in the flowers, and how they place them, what they choose, I think is very creative.
Well, it's just so nice to be part of that process where the local bee populations are benefiting from your work and all of the other good things that can happen from a well-planted garden.
Yes, and a lot of them really, I think, are for everybody. Maybe because the yards are small, but you walk by and everybody enjoys them.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your call today. Oh, did we do the icebreaker? Did you tell me what kind of food you couldn't stand as a kid?
Oh, and I still don't like it. The the sweet carrot, raisin, mayonnaise-y, is it considered a salad or coleslaw or something? And my father, on my case about forcing me to eat it, and I just, all that together was not good.
That sounds like my mom's famous recipe, Adele's Pink Fluff, that none of us could manage to have more than a bite of. But yeah, I think I know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Well, good to hear from you, Susanna. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks to everyone who has called in so far. Looking at three open phone lines, and that means it's your turn, 503-325-0010. Let us know the answer to the icebreaker question: what kind of food could you not stand as a kid, and do you enjoy it now? And then also, where are some examples of originality that you've witnessed these days? I loved doing ceramics in high school. I took several semesters of it as an elective and thought I might have a future as a ceramics teacher. I was so inspired by mine. But I met this one gentleman who was a neighbor of my grandmother's, and he had this technique where he would let this kind of 90-degree bent knife rest on it as it was turning. This is the trimming phase, and it would sort of tap on it, and it would create these really incredible textures on the pot or on the lid that I had never seen anyone do before. And so I loved that he had found a way to be original, and maybe he didn't create that technique, but somebody did. So that's another good example. What's your example? 503-325-0010. Ron, you're a historian, which I suppose that means you have an interesting relationship with originality in some ways, but you're also looking for stories that have existed for a long time. As a historian, is there opportunity for originality?
Well, I think overall, yes, because I think, you know, from a historian perspective, as far as, you know, you look at something, and I call them like a treasure hunt, and that becomes originality, because we know certain things, you know, for whatever reason, has been misinterpreted. And as far as having the opportunity to be able to do that, and that's across the board, doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, or what the family history is about and stuff. But I think when you come up with these sort of concepts of history, your history, or just Oregon history. I think, like, even for Franklin Delano Roosevelt being at Timberline Lodge, you know, people look like, wow, well, so that's almost an original thing, but that's history, you know. Mm-hmm. And as far as being able to look at that, and I think, like I said, when you look at that, an individual will go to Timberline Lodge and stand in that same spot that FDR stood in. And the fact of that history, it becomes sort of an original sort of deal to be able to motivate a person. And like I said, it's just like, whoa, I took a photo of my phone, you know, where FDR stood. So I think it's really kind of, you know, to be able to do it. For me personally, I think almost every other day, there's usually something out there that gets my personal curiosity. And for me, from an original, you know, sort of thing and motivational, however you want to look at it, that keeps me going. Because like I said, we have so much history that's there that has been, has not been discovered or misinterpretation. And as I tell some of the younger students, is the fact that the idea of being able to look at these things and wow, this is really great that this happened. I didn't know anything about it. Another thing is, like I said, back to the photo, the idea with the, as far as foods, is like, you know, you think about Brussels sprouts, you think about broccoli, and you think about cauliflower. Now, I've been to the restaurant the last year or so, and cauliflower has become a side dish, and they have taken it to a different level. And as far as my experience, the cauliflower was the same thing with the Brussels sprouts and, you know, and things of that nature. And then at the same time, as far as originality and creativity, however you look at it, I think for me personally, one of the greatest points is food carts. Across the board, to me, they're just totally exciting. The fact that, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, because it's kind of basic as far as people putting together. And it takes, historically, goes back to the point where people were just sitting there doing small businesses, whatever it is. It's like, you know, all of a sudden, this is my big kitchen that I have out there on the side of the road. And that, you know, originality and creativity and stuff is there in the food carts. Because when I walk through Astoria and stuff, you know, food carts pop up here. I mean, the traditional ones that are there, but I think it's really incredible.
Amen. Yeah. Well, hey, 12 minutes left in the show, 503-325-0010. Lots of time to get your call in. Three open phone lines. Give us a ring. And once the 10 o'clock hour comes around, feel free to call back and make a pledge of support to KMUN during our spring pledge drive. Did you know that you can also earmark your donation for KCPB if you're a listener to our classical music and news station? You can donate as a KCPB member, and that just lets us know that you appreciate that side of the service as well, and helps us know how much you value it and enjoy the great classical music that you can hear all day long and the expansion of news coverage as well. So 503-325-0010 is the number to call. We're talking about the concept of originality today. And one of the things that we heard from a couple of callers is that original ideas come to us from the ether. And that reminded me of a... I don't know if... I guess it was one of those master classes with David Lynch, a filmmaker, who he has a pretty good metaphor for that concept. And he thinks of ideas as fish, and that you need to catch fish. You need to catch your ideas. But it's not super easy to catch a fish. And, you know, and also he's saying that you don't make the fish, you catch it. And I like also what he says, that if you want to catch little fish, you can stay in the shallow water. But if you want to catch the big fish, you've got to go deeper. Down deep, the fish are more powerful and more pure. And I think he's talking about ideas, you know, at this point. I suppose that the fish thing is true, too. So, what's an example of a fish that you've caught lately that was original? Or... Where does originality exist in the world that you appreciate? We've heard about the design of cars, gardening, technology, electricity generation. I think there's a lot of room for originality right now as we hopefully move towards greener sources of power and energy. 503-325-0010, just 10 minutes left. Three open phone lines. It's your turn. Give us a call. We should just have a long pregnant pause, Ron, while we wait for the phone to ring. What do you think?
Oh, first thing came to my mind, you said fishing. I said, well, because this guy is out there right now, Hemingway. You know, he went for the deep fish.
Oh, so he did, yeah.
Writer, so yeah. Do we get a, is there a line somewhere with that as far as being able to do that? Because, you know, once again, from a historical perspective, I think to give even more credence to what you're saying as far as, or quote, as far as, you know, the fishing, because you go out there and, like I said, all I can do is go personally and stuff. And I hope people don't tire of me saying those little personal anecdotes, but the idea that I would listen to people. And I think to me, that was kind of my fishing expedition still today, the fact of listening to what people are saying. And I'm not listening to everybody, but yet at the same time, to be able to sit in a social situation. And I think, you know, as far as I'm not really a bar fly, but at the same time, to be able to sit in a corner somewhere and listen to people's conversation, not, you know, they're talking generally to everybody there. To me, it's always exciting. And to be able to, you know, hear what people think. And like, again, the original ideas, a lot of times that'll be the thing that'll, you know, prep you to be able to go to the next level. And for me, it's just a curiosity. And like I said, it's always a fishing trip every day with me.
Yeah, great. Well, that kind of makes me think of the idea that every single one of us as individuals is original. We are inherently original. I've not existed before. You've not existed before. You can't even really duplicate us.
Well, I don't know. One of these things about past life experiences. I think that as we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, the idea that, you know, we're, like I said, we're original and that's it. But, you know, you have a little bit of your, you know, whether from Australia, saying, you know, or New Zealand area stuff, there's something that we're still out there and it's going to pop up on you next week. All of a sudden, that's that fishing expedition is there. And I think a lot of times we don't even aren't aware of it. But like I said, being open-minded, I mean, you're so much, as far as that's why you're in that chair right now. The fact that the concept of being able to look at things and with a broader scope, because if you don't have a, you know, the fishing out there and stuff, well, then you're going to miss it. And for me, it's not like a statement across the board. It's just for me personally. And I think you have some of those same, you know, as far as practical approaches.
Yeah. I think we're getting into it now. Cause this, you know, this makes me think that, okay, so if I'm just a bunch of pieces of other things that have existed before, or maybe a car, you know, you take this motor and you take that door and you take this roof and these tires, just because you stick different things together in a new combination, does that constitute originality? You know?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. I like your confidence.
Yeah. Well, it's always like, once again, like I said, it's just a metaphor as far as the cars, looking at them and stuff, because even today, like I said, you know, once again, these little courses, I've never owned a new car because that was my contribution to the environment. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as having an electric car, I'm not against that. I support it 100%. But once again, that's not me right now. I mean, they're still going to be, within my lifetime, always going to be, you know, fossil fuel vehicles. So I'm recycling that vehicle and still driving it around. And I think for me personally, it's one of those things to be able to look at them. And as I said earlier to me, and it was not only like, you know, as far as a European, Italian cars or whatever, it's the fact, because even, like I said, the fins on the American cars, you know, we're looking at them. So that was the whole concept. You look at some of the cars in the 50s, the bumpers, the grills, I mean, you look for one different, you know, General Motors and then another car, they were totally different. But if you're looking at three different cars right now, the front bumpers and stuff, they all look the same. And so sometimes to me, the originality, I'm not, you know, diminishing what people go through to be able to get to that certain level. But I think like I said, the thing, it was just an art thing. And I think for me, seeing a vehicle is just like, it's like a piece of artwork to me personally. And I'd be, like to be able to see it. And like I said, it's going to get to another level because there are some, you know, breakaway now, some of the cars looking a little different and stuff, the really tiny cars, things of that nature and stuff, which were back in the 50s, they had little tiny cars, you know. But I just think, you know, for me, it's always kind of interesting because let's face it, the cars are always around us. And to be able to see that and what people, like I say, it's not for everyone and stuff, but, you know, it could be classical music or it could be, you know, any type of music, the fact of what they look at as far as appreciating the originality and stuff. But because, like I said, classical music to me is incredible, you know, and that's what it is.
Yeah, music is a good example of taking pre-existing things and putting them together in a new order and creating something original. But talking about cars made me think of other vehicles as well, and we all like boats and maritime stuff around here. So it made me think of the different designs of sailboats over the centuries as the designs improved and boats got a keel or boats got articulating sails or, you know, and so the current most common type of sailing vessel is sort of an amalgamation of several different advances in boat design from different parts of the world, where we got together and got to put a piece of the Viking hull with a piece of the Japanese sail. And, you know, mm-hmm. I'm not making correct statements here, but I'm trying to just get the idea across. But, you know, there had to be that first person who said, you know what? What if we put this really heavy, big piece of wood right down the middle on the bottom and see if that helps stabilize it? Or what if we build a sail like this and then we can sail into the wind for the first time ever? It's pretty extraordinary. It's amazing what humans are capable of.
Yeah, I think, you know, with that whole scenario, as far as, you know, you look at, you know, the World Cup as far as sailors, you know, what the ships you look from, what Ted Turner was involved in and stuff like that. And to today, what the sailboats look like. And I mean, they weren't for cruising around the San Juan Islands. These were racing things and technology. And you're absolutely right to be able to get the maximum amount. But still, again, you know, look at old photographs of the sailboats out here and on the river here when they were fishing, you know, back in the 20s and stuff, you know, like, whoa. And I've had people say, well, so where is that? Is that in, you know, somewhere in the Middle East? No, it's on this river right here because it was similar to what was going on in some of the areas around the world and stuff. But yet at the same time, as I tell people before, the Columbia River is an international highway. Right. And so the idea that people are, you know, fishermen and sailors, they're not stupid. They're looking at it and saying, well, okay, I can do this and make it more efficient.
So, it's also an incredibly dangerous and challenging super international highway.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't go out there on holidays.
So is that the butterfly fleet of boats that you're talking about?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. I used to pass by the Wana Bank where the mural is. So that was where my history lesson on the butterfly fleet started. Well, Ron, we got to wrap it up, but it's been great having a conversation with you and everyone else who called in today. Thank you so much. And thanks to all who have donated to our spring pledge drive. You've still got another 10 days. And I would be remiss if I didn't wrap up the show without giving a shout out to my dear brother, Peter, whose birthday is today. Happy birthday, Peter. Love you.
Happy birthday, Peter.
Yeah. All right. Well, Ron, I look forward to our next history lesson with you next week. And we'll see you soon.
Take care.
Thanks again to everybody who called in. You are tuned in to KMUN Astoria, 91.9 FM, KTCB Tillamook, 89.5 FM. We stream on the web, kmun.org, and you can listen to us on a mobile device using a radio app, like TuneIn. It's always a joy hosting this show. I look forward to doing it again next week. Every Wednesday at 9 o'clock, it's our live call-in show. Hope to hear from you. Love new callers. Love new members, 503-325-0010.